Now, you might know Richard O'Brien as the presenter of Channel 4's Crystal Maze, or indeed as the creator of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. But you know what? More than that, he's one of those great life-affirming anarchic one-offs who makes the world a better place. And I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Hello, Richard.
Well, what a lovely introduction. Thank you, Brendan.
You're so welcome.
I've been reading that you've had a hit record yourself. I don't know whether you were Father Brown or the Cardinals. Which one were you?
I was Father Brown. The fun-loving Cardinals were my production crew.
Excellent.
Yes. But you know what? I didn't have the good business sense to expand it out into a whole musical.
Well, there you go.
So, and you're here with us today because the Rocky Horror Picture Show is coming to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin. And you won't be there, but you'll be there in spirit, I guess. Is it nice?
I certainly will.
Is it nice for you sitting down there in New Zealand knowing that the show is always going on out there somewhere, isn't it?
It's marvellous. It's going to be 50 years of this show next year. Considering it really was a fringe theatre event that was only meant to run for 3 weeks fun, is astonishing, because nobody would have dreamt that it would have had a life like this.
No.
It is really, when you think about it, is a piece of juvenility, isn't it? It's a lovely piece of juvenility, but it's little more. It's rather wonderful.
Yeah, you must be surprised yourself at the enduring appeal of it. I'm wondering, is it a safe way for people to go out and have a slightly transgressive experience and then they go home to the kids again?
I'm not sure whether that's it, but it's certainly got a party atmosphere attached to it. It's one of those shows that it doesn't rely upon the theatrical kind of members of society. It appeals to people who want a night out. And generally, people in an office might book to go together in a party. And the party mood sort of invades the theatre, because once they've got home, they'll probably have a wee drink and maybe make an effort to put a bit of slap on. And by the time they get to the theatre, they bring that party atmosphere into the auditorium before even the curtain goes up. And it's a lovely audience to play to.
Yeah, I bet. It's funny, the kind of genderqueer element and the transvestite from transsexual Transylvania seems in a way to us almost quaint. Now, was it considered very outre back then, 50 years ago, when you first started?
I don't think it's always had a kind of... the odd thing is that it just amused rather than upset. I can't remember any negative kinds of vibes coming at the show. Perhaps only in New York City, but I think that was because the producers dared to say, "Here's the hit from Los Angeles, from London and Los Angeles," and I think New York took umbrage at that because they thought we were jumping the gun, and they kind of said that it's not up to you to tell us it's a hit. We're going to tell you, and since you've had the temerity to say it is, we're going to tell you it's not. In other words, I think in the shorthand is that New York said that they were urbane and witty, and that Los Angeles was kind of like, you know, a cheap tarts locker.
And listen, was the vibe and the aesthetic of the show coming from your own life? Were you on some kind of, I don't know, was there a fetish or a cross-dressing scene or whatever was around back then?
I think it was probably it was a cathartic to some extent or other. If I can honestly say that if I hadn't been transgendered myself, Frankenfurter would never have seen the light of day. That would have been a shame.
Yeah, so you mentioned that you're transgender. And look, I don't ask everyone who comes on the show about their gender or sexuality,
no.
I promise. But yours does seem interesting. so you identify as transgender now?
I think that's what I am. I have this theory that all of us are on a continuum between hardwired male and hardwired female, and that we all lie somewhere on that continuum. And I think I'm probably in there about 60% male, 40% female, something of that nature.
And it's interesting you say that we're all on a continuum, because I sometimes think we've become obsessed with gender now and with labelling ourselves gender-wise, whereas in fact the truth is probably that, do you not think we're maybe all our own individual gender and, you know, as you say, somewhere on the continuum there?
I think that's possibly true. I think the people that have a problem with it probably cause problems for other people, because they're caught up in their own strange world and not... We live in a binary... Well, we did in the past, anyway. We lived in a very binary kind of society. And so, therefore, those that were marginalised used to get hurt. I mean, I'd have hated to have been a gay back in the 1950s, the 40s and the 50s. It must have been dreadful for people.
Yeah, but it must have been difficult for you as well, being being what you were. When did you actually declare your transgenderism?
Well, I think I probably did in my dress sense. I was pretty out there. I mean, I remember the first time I went to a party in a frock, someone said, "Oh, you've come out the closet." And I said, "Well, I may well have been in the closet, but the door was wider."
And were you like this from childhood?
Yes, I distinctly remember saying to my elder brother when I was six that I wanted to be the fairy princess when I grew up, and I saw and heard the disdain, and you know, so the shutters come down, and that's not healthy.
Yeah, but again, I'm thinking, so you were six, that's like nearly 75 years ago. We obviously have a lot of language around this now, and people see role models and examples of maybe whatever their particular place in the scheme of things is. But I'm wondering, back then, did you understand what you were? Was it even a concept then, or was there language for it?
No. And even if you'd said anything to your parents, they'd have been just as lost as well. They wouldn't have known what to do. The other thing, of course, is misogynism kind of rules the world. Phallocentric, patriarchal misogynism rules the world, and that's not healthy either. We need to get more women empowered all over the world, and I think that misogynism made it more difficult. It was much easier to be a tomboy than it was to be a fey young man. Families thought they had a problem if the son was gay, but they didn't have a problem if the girl was butch. That was always been odd. But that's misogynism.
Okay, because the idea being that, well, if you were lucky enough to be a boy and to be a man, why would anyone choose to want to be more of a woman?
I don't quite see the luck involved, but yes.
Okay. Well, you don't. Yeah. I'm talking about the mores of the time, obviously. Yeah. So like this is.
I actually, thinking back on what you said, you're probably right. I am when you say there was luck involved. I know that if I'd been a girl, I wouldn't have been able to walk down the streets that I've walked down and been in the places I've been and had the life that I've lived. I know that's a certainty.
Yeah. So this is all happening, you, just to give people a context on it, you were a teenager in, say, what, like 50s, 60s New Zealand?
Yeah, I turned a teenager the very year they coined that phrase, actually. Up until that time, there was no such thing
as
teenagers.
Okay, so when it was James Dean kind of credited with inventing the notion of the teenager, you were actually there live as one of that first generation of teenagers.
Yes, and it's very interesting you should mention him, because I think teenagers was invented by people who at that time had just come out of university with degrees in psychology. This was a new step, and with these new chaps coming out of university with that particular degree, what could they do with it? They went into probation, officers, and they became probation officers, and they tried to understand the teenager. In fact, I'm very grateful for them, to them, because they gave us a bit of leeway. We weren't, they were trying to understand us because we were deeply troubled teens, you see.
Yes.
And thus deeply troubled teens wanted to be understood and worried about, because and teenagers are narcissistic.
Yeah, and I gather you were quite a troublesome teen. Were you sent away to a farm to kind of, I won't use the phrase straighten you out, but to get you out of trouble?
It wasn't quite like that, but it wasn't far off either. And yeah, I did go off to a training farm when I was 15, and we were put into barracks with lots of other boys, and it was a lot of acreage. I think we had over 3,000 acres. It was run by the Salvation Army, and it was pretty strict and in its way. Did it straighten me out? I don't think so.
Clearly not.
I think I was caned at school to make a man of me. I can't think of any other reasons why I was caned at school. It was pretty relentless.
Really, yeah. And so all of this pressure then to, as you say, make a man of you, were you all the time then, you're nursing this other identity and this other, not an inclination, but this part of you. So are you hiding away that feminine part of you all the time during all of this?
Well, that's what I was just saying to you. As far as I can see, I wasn't shouting out off the rooftops about it, but I would have thought, I remember when I was up, I came back to New Zealand several 20 or 30 years ago, and I was talking to a journalist, and I opened up and said that I was transgendered, and my family went, no, 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 no. My mother went, no, 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 no. And I said, I think, you know, when I was at Rob's garden at the barbecue the other week, wearing dance tights and a ballet rock, cowboy boots and makeup and earrings, I think, you know, you should have got a clue there.
So we had you then as a young person and you're, without there being language or anything else, you're living this life where you're kind of somewhere in between. As you get older then, and as this maybe comes more into the mainstream, the idea of blurred gender and everything, did you have a kind of a journey to full acceptance or to figuring out, okay, so this is what I am and there are other people like me and this is not unusual?
It's not at all unusual. I didn't worry too much about it because I'm in the theatre. I was given more leeway. I was allowed.
Yes.
I was allowed to dress in a more flamboyant manner, simply because I was in the theatre. If I'd been a headmaster or a policeman or a fireman or something like that, that might have been a different kind of journey, a more difficult journey. But I'm supposed to be arty, so I'm allowed to be eccentric to some extent.
Yeah, yeah, and that is interesting. So overall, you would say, for you, it's been more fun to be the way you are rather than the difficult road it can be for some people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So then you moved to England at some stage. Was this would have been, I'm trying to figure out the kind of times and everything. Was this the swinging 60s when you moved to London?
No, I came back to England in 1964. We came to New Zealand in 52. I was 10 years of age. At the age of 22, I returned to Great Britain simply for a year's working holiday because I had no idea what I wanted to do. In 65, I got a job riding horses and movies, and that introduced me into show business. And then I went to drama school and evening school in 64, 65 and 66. And there I met other people. I was very lucky. I met Chrissy Shrimpton. You may remember that Jean Shrimpton was a major model.
Yes.
And her sister Chrissy was Mick Jagger's girlfriend, and I'm very grateful for Chrissy because she introduced me to rock and roll society in London in 65, and you couldn't be in a better place, could you?
Oh, God, I can imagine.
I started writing songs with a young chap called Arthur Kelly from Liverpool, and Arthur had been to school with George Harrison. George had asked him to become a Beatle, and before they went off to Hamburg, and he said to George he had a job as a wages clerk, and he was getting £5, 10 shillings a week, and he wasn't going to give that up for anybody. So Arthur and I wrote songs for a couple of years, and then I worked in so many theatres backstage and theatres over during this time as well. And after a while, I got the job working in the theatre as an acting, and it started, my life started to take off in that direction.
Okay, and can I be nosy and ask? I it's great to hear about the work and the career progression, but was it great fun as well being around London in the 60s, sex, drugs, and rock and roll wise?
Being in the King's Road, going down the King's Road on a Saturday morning in the 60s was a wonderful experience. None of us had much money,
yeah,
but we had a lot of style and a lot of freedom and joy and a lot of laughter.
Yeah, so that does sound like it was a hugely liberating time for all the freaks and the different people.
Yes, indeed, and it led finally to glam rock, which was right up my alley, and opened doors as well. And more, you were allowed to be more flamboyant, and in fact, you were encouraged to be more flamboyant in that period of time. Rocky sits right in that little gap,
yeah,
between the end of glam rock and the burgeoning of punk. Malcolm McLaren used to come to the show on a regular basis because he just used to wander in and stand in the back of the theatre after the curtain had gone up. His shop was just for 5 minutes from our theatre, and so he was in regular attendance. And when the show opened in New York City, Malcolm came backstage and took me out. He said, "I'm going to sign up a group. I'm going to sign up a group, the New York Dolls, actually." And we went to see them. He didn't sign them, but he went back to England and signed up the Sex Pistols. So, in some small way, we were instrumental in British punk sort of emergence.
Wow, yeah, and it's interesting you say that. You see, having not lived through it, we look back now and you think of glam rock as being kind of the old order, if you will, the end of the old order, and punk being the beginning of the new order. But as you say, it all kind of blurred together, and actually the jumps between those, it was quite quick. Like the New York Dolls were basically almost a glam band, but then kind of invented that New York style of punk.
Indeed. It was a different kind of punk, wasn't it? CBGBs and all that lot.
Yeah. So do you embrace the punk scene then as well, did you?
Not to the... I can't bear shouting. I like melody. I love people that can sing. I think singing is the purest art form. And shouting at people doesn't win me over. A great, great, great pounding rock and roll band. But I'm not into people who shout at me.
Yeah, okay. So tell me then about how the Rocky Horror Picture Show developed out of all this life you were living at the time.
Well, I'd been in Jesus Christ Superstar. I'd been contracted to take over the role of Herod from a guy called Paul Jabara, an American actor. And a British Equity said he can play it for 3 months, but after that time a British actor should take the role, and that was me. When it push came to shove, Stigwood didn't want me to play the role, and put me on for one afternoon evening show, and I failed the audition. And so they were in breach of contract then, and so they paid me off. I think £300 is what I got, and I went home and wrote my own musical. the lucky thing was being let go was the luckiest thing that could have happened to me. It didn't seem like it at the time, but if I'd stayed there, I probably would never have dreamt of writing a musical of my own.
Yeah, you'd be an aging musical theatre actor out there somewhere now who no one had ever heard of, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. You did a lot of different things then in film work and everything else, but I suspect musical theatre is what gives you your buzz. Is it the live audience and the dressing up and all that kind of thing? That's where your heart is it?
Well, dressing up and making believe is what theatre's all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, people try to make more of it. Actors get very serious about themselves, but really, that's all they're doing. It's a strange world where we get far too much acknowledgement and praise for doing our job. If we were plumbers, we wouldn't get half the kind of attention.
And then it was kind of an unlikely thing for you to do in a way, but people will remember there was this kind of 4 or 5 year period where you presented a show called The Crystal Maze on Channel 4, and I was thinking back on it. And I kind of think you probably wouldn't get away with it these days. You were quite, I won't say rude, but you were kind of acerbic to the contestants, weren't you?
Well, you see, Brendan, I didn't realise that I was. I was just reacting in the same way. I put it this way. If you and I were playing a brand new card game, a card game you'd never played before, and I said to you, right, let's play a dummy round. And you go, okay. And at the end of that dummy round, I say, do you understand how it works? And you go, well, not quite. I say, okay, we'll have another dummy round. After that, now we're playing for real, and you start messing up then. I'm quite at liberty to say, for crying out loud, Brendan, we've played 2 dummy rounds, for heaven's sakes, get it together. And you wouldn't be offended. And I used to spend time with the contestants the night before. I'd have dinner with the contestants the night before. I'd let them tell me their jokes, and we'd spot, and we'd sit around. And by the end of the evening, we can be relaxed with each other. So when I snapped, it wasn't really, there was no offensiveness in it. I was just being myself, actually. Nobody really minded. The producers loved it, and they wanted me to be the first time when they started to edit the shows together and saw that I was being, as you say, acerbic. They wanted more of that, and I said, no, I'm not going to act angry with them. I'm not going to do Anne Robinson, for instance.
Yes.
I think that's she took on that kind of role, and I just found it rather offensive. I didn't go out of my way to offend or hurt anybody. I was just being, jollying them along.
Yeah. And look, it was hugely popular at the time, people will remember. Listen, Richard, you don't seem like the type to be 80. How are you finding it?
80?
Yeah.
There's nothing good to be said about getting old.
Yeah.
It's annoying. I get bad tempered, and I think most people get bad tempered because things are taken away from us incrementally. First, your sight goes a little bit, then your hearing goes a little bit, then your back goes, and then your peripheral vision goes, and your balance goes, and what the hell's going on here?
Yeah.
It's not right.
And do you work much?
Do I what?
Do you work much these days?
I write a song occasionally for my own pleasure. I write little tales for my grandchildren and then illustrate them. And that's about it. I've got a project in LA at the moment, which is a satirical fairy tale called The Kingdom of Bling. We're hoping to turn that into an animated film.
Okay, so you're keeping yourself busy, but you mentioned grandchildren and things like that. It sounds in a way like you've kind of retired semi into quite a conventional kind of a life down there, have you?
Well, we've got a nice big back porch, and it's filled up with people on the weekend, many of them musicians, and we you know, we live a lovely life out here, truthfully.
Yeah, well, look, the Rocky Horror Picture Show is still out there around the world doing its little bit anyway to for tolerance and difference and everything else. Richard, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
You're a darling man, Brendan. Thank you so much.
Okay.
And all the best to you and your loved ones.
Okay, and you too. And good luck with the ageing. I hope it doesn't get any worse for you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay.
Bye-bye.
And the Rocky Horror Picture Show will be in the Borgosh Energy Theatre from January 30th to February 4th.
Email brendan@rte.ie.